Greetings, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the CMCS Allstate Medicaid and CHIP call webinar. During the presentation, all participants will be in a listen-only mode. Afterwards, we will conduct a question and answer session. At that time, if you have a question, please press star followed by the number one on your telephone, or you can ask questions in the chat box at the bottom of your screen. If at any time during the conference you need to reach an operator, please press star zero. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded on Tuesday, September 29th, 2020. I would now like to turn the conference over to Jackie Glaze, and please go ahead.
Thank you so much, and good afternoon, and welcome everyone to today's Allstate webinar call. I will now turn the call over to Emory Costello, and she will provide highlights for today's discussion. Emory?
Great. Thanks, Jackie, and thanks to everyone for joining us today. This afternoon, we'll hear from CMCS staff about how TMSIS data is being used to analyze the impact of COVID-19 on service utilization. Kim Proctor, a technical director in our Data and Systems Group, will present preliminary data snapshot released last week that examines the impact of COVID-19 on service utilization for children age 18 and under enrolled in the Medicaid and CHIP programs. This is a critically important presentation because preliminary findings show that service utilization for children has dropped precipitously during the first few months of the public health emergency. We're all aware of the many ways that COVID-19 upended our lives. As doctors' offices and schools closed, many families have been forced to postpone much-needed medical care for their children. But the absence of vital health care services may have lifelong consequences for our vulnerable children, contributing sometimes to developmental delays and exacerbating existing health care disparities. We all have a role to play to ensure all children receive the care they need. State and local agencies, providers, schools, and other key stakeholders must work together to address this issue and strive to treat the millions of children who have already missed important medical services. Providers should conduct active outreach to make sure families understand that it's safe to come back to the office to receive care. Catching up on childhood vaccinations is also vital. These efforts are important for children getting the flu vaccine, and when the time comes, also the COVID vaccine. We hope that states, territories, and other stakeholders can use the results that you'll learn about today to help drive better healthcare outcomes for some of our nation's most vulnerable beneficiaries. Please consider today's presentation a call to action to develop a system of care to make sure that these children receive the care that they need. After Kim's presentation, we'll open the lines up for questions. Following that discussion, we'll hear a brief update from Jackie Glaze, the Deputy Director of the Medicaid and CHIP Operations Group, who will address the intersection between the waivers and flexibilities granted during the COVID-19 public health emergency and any waivers needed to address other emergencies such as the wildfires or recent hurricanes. Finally, we'll open up the lines for our general questions. But before we turn to our featured presentation, I wanted to share two announcements with the state Medicaid directors listening to today's call. First, I want to draw to your attention an email that the National Association of Medicaid Directors shared with state Medicaid directors on my behalf last Wednesday, requesting your review of the 2020 Medicaid and CHIP scorecard. Your partnership in this initiative is greatly appreciated, so we want to urge you to review the content and provide any feedback that you'd like to share with CMS, and you can send that directly to Karen Yanos by the end of today. We know that many states have already reviewed and submitted their data. For those of you who are still trying to get across the finish line and reviewing the draft 2020 Medicaid and CHIP scorecard, there's still some hours left in the day to get that information to us. Secondly, I'd also like to remind the state Medicaid directors and their staff of the new 5-year mandatory medication assistance treatment benefit that becomes effective this Thursday, October 1st. This benefit is intended to increase access to evidence-based treatment for opioid use disorder for all Medicaid beneficiaries. We are aware that Congress may be addressing the issue of Medicaid rebates under this new benefit and intend to share information via our CMS listserv on whether rebates may be claimed for drugs provided under this new mandatory benefit. Additional guidance on the MAT benefit as a whole is being cleared and will be issued by CMS as soon as possible. With that, I'm going to turn things over to Kim to get her presentation started. Kim?
Hi, everyone. I'm Kim Proctor. Thanks for the introduction, Anne-Marie. And before I start, I just want to thank everyone else from CMS, from DSG, and our contractors who helped support this work. So I'm a technical director in the Division of Business and Data Analytics in the Data and Systems Group. And as Anne-Marie mentioned, today we're going to discuss the slides that CMS recently released regarding service use among Medicaid and CHIP beneficiaries age 18 and under. So we can show you our results, we can answer any of your questions, and we can give you a chance to give us some feedback about the slides. I know that Anne-Marie mentioned that we view the slides as a call to action, and I also want to reiterate that point. And I do want to add that we do have some state-specific results on a number of slides, but we didn't include those to focus on any specific states as high or low performers or in any of our other documentation where we talk about states. The goal there is really to show that there is substantial variation across states. And we encourage you and our other state and local partners to look further into this issue for your specific environment. So I think it's just really to highlight that different things are happening, and it's important to understand what's happening in your local environment. And please feel free to follow up with us after the call if you have more specific questions about what we are seeing for your state. So this slide is just a table of contents. It's a pretty long presentation, and we want you to be able to go back and look at it and look at the specific areas that you're interested in. So for this content overview, I'm sure everyone on this call is very familiar with most of the things that we'll talk about here, but we do just want to highlight some of the key things that went into this presentation. So from a population perspective, we include anyone who's enrolled for at least one day in Medicaid or CHIP who's age 18 or under. So, you know, this is based on TMCIF. That is a little bit of a higher enrollment number, the higher enrollment numbers on this slide than you might normally see, and that's why we have a more expansive definition. So that's where we're getting that from. From a treatment perspective, I want to highlight that CMS does not get lab results. So we only get claims where someone has received treatment for COVID-19. We don't know how many positive cases there are for Medicaid and CHIP. We only know that treatment rate. So please keep that in mind when you are looking at these results. And as everyone on this call is probably well aware, and we highlight on basically every slide and every footnote in our appendices, we know that it can take a while for states to send claims to CMS for a variety of different reasons. So we want users of the slides to interpret the results with caution. We know that the results will change as more claims are submitted. But with that said, we felt like the results coming through on these slides, they were so significant that we feel confident that the trends will remain even once more claims are submitted, but please do keep that caution in the back of your mind. And then kind of the same thing for that last bullet. Even when we have every single state, every single claim from every single state, there are still features of state submissions and data quality concerns that we have for the different states to keep in mind when you are interpreting the results. So from a high level of why is this presentation important? So we're covering nearly 40 million children. That includes about 75% of all children living in poverty and many, many children with special health care needs. So just given that really high level context, making sure that these children receive the care they need is especially important, and especially given everything we know about what's happening right now. And then kind of right before we get into the results, highlighting that point again about claims lag. So I just want to highlight that one more time, and we've been very thorough about this, hopefully, in our presentation that comes across. So, you know, as you're aware, CMS collects this information only for programmatic purposes, not for public health reasons. There's always a lag between when a service occurs and when we are going to have a record of it in the CMS system. The length of that lag will depend on the state, the claim type, and the delivery system. It is possible that the claims lag is even longer because of the pandemic itself, and we won't fully know that for some time. So just keep that in mind that historically, 90% of fee-for-service claims across all claim types are submitted within 7 months. 90% of encounters are submitted within 12 months. I mean, that's a fairly long time, right? But there is a lot of variation. So some states will meet those numbers within 4 months. Some states might take the full year. So with that in mind, you know, please think about this as you're interpreting our results. I will say that the majority of this presentation relies on outpatient claims. There are some inpatient claims. You know, outpatient claims are a lot faster than inpatient claims, so I think that that's positive in terms of forming conclusions. But we just really want to highlight this time and time again for our users. Okay, so if you were going to listen to one thing through the whole presentation, I think this slide would be the thing to listen to. And that is just that the key takeaway is that we are seeing a significant decline in primary preventive and mental health services for children. And we are seeing an increase in the number of services delivered via telehealth. And we saw a drastic increase in April, but that is not nearly enough to offset the decline for the loss of in-person services. And that decline occurred even though the COVID-19 treatment rate for children appears to be low, especially relative to other groups. And at this point, our data is showing that fewer than 0.1% of children received treatment for COVID-19 under Medicaid or CHIP with fewer than 1,000 hospitalizations. So kind of the key takeaway is that it appears, based on preliminary evidence, that the COVID-19 treatment rate for kids is low, but that these sort of secondary effects of lost care might be very, very high. Okay, so getting into the slide on the results. So the slides are all kind of structured the same way, which will help you when you go back and look at them. I promise I will not read every word on this slide to you. But we tried to put a lot of information on these slides so that they could totally stand on their own. So in this case, like, you should be able to read the headline, all the notes, and understand exactly what we were trying to say. And the way they kind of work is they tell you that takeaway message, they talk a little bit about the rates, and then they show some charts which have the actual numbers on them. The solid purple line is always 2020, and then those like dotted lines or dashed lines are previous years. And we tried to include as many previous years as we could so that you could just get a sense for the actual trend, because some of the things we'll show have like strong seasonality in the results. And then the footnotes always have our disclaimers about what to think about. So that's high level how to look at these slides. So for this specific slide, we look at vaccinations for children under the age of 2. And the next slide focuses on some state results for that. But basically what the results show is that vaccination rates have dropped drastically across the United States, with 22% fewer vaccinations for kids under 2 during this time period, which translates to roughly 1.7 million vaccines, which is obviously a lot of vaccines and very concerning. And then although we are currently seeing levels start to level off or rise in May, we're still not quite at those normal rates yet, which indicates that we not only need to return to our prior year levels, but we also need to make up for all of that lost care. And then this slide is just showing that there's substantial variation across states regarding vaccination rates. So once again, it's not to compare states as much as it is to highlight that all states are different, that you should investigate your local environment to see what options there are for you. We've started working on compiling, you know, the actual output for every single state, and I can tell you just reading through those and looking at those, you do see very big differences, not just across states, but also across different treatments. So we would really encourage you to think about these different results for your state. And the key takeaway here is that some states have begun to return to pre-pandemic levels, which is great, but others are still having a strong lag. And then given that we have lost so many vaccines in that foregone care, we would want to see rates, at least for some time, exceed pre-pandemic levels. Okay, and then on this slide, you're going to see basically the same kind of analysis for child screening. So it's a very similar story, namely that the preliminary data show that the number of child screening services declined through April. We did start to see a rise again in May, but it is still substantially lower than what was there in prior years. So that translates to over 3.2 million fewer child screens, or a drop of 44% compared to the same time period from 2019. And I think that this one is especially concerning, knowing that we normally see a really large seasonal increase in late summer, early fall. So basically, you know, when kids return to school, we see a lot of child screens. And given that a lot of schools are not open for in-person learning, I think there is definitely a concern that we might not see that large seasonal bump. So this is one where we really will want to continue to monitor as time goes on to make sure that not only are we kind of making up for what we've lost, but if we lost our seasonal bump, that is also an additional concern. And then here you're going to see similar output on state variation. There's significant variation across states. Some states are already starting to rise, which is great. The May levels do continue to remain below pre-pandemic levels in nearly all states, which is concerning, but we would hope to see the rise in many states continue. And for those states that are still lagging, we would hope to see an increase over time. And then this slide shows dental services. So this one has, we have really seen an enormous, and especially enormous drop in dental services. So you can see here that 69% fewer dental services, which is about 7.6 million missing dental services during this time period. So as you can see from these slides, the treatment rate basically fell over 90% in April, I mean, which was just an astronomical drop. So, you know, we've seen a very large drop in this area, and we really haven't seen that recovery start yet. And then we're showing kind of the same story through all these state-specific slides, which is just that they're reiterating this trend, that the rates fell drastically, there is a lot of variation, some states are starting to rebound in May, and that we hope to continue to see a rise in service use in these areas as time progresses. And for states that are still lagging, we hope that they can get back to pre-pandemic levels soon. The next three slides will focus on mental health services for children. So the first slide shows the decline in outpatient mental health service use through May. You can see that while telehealth for mental health services did increase, it is not nearly enough to offset this decline. So just looking at this, the pink lines are that outpatient mental health services for 2020 and 2019. The green lines are those services delivered via telehealth. You can see, like, well, you can't really see the 2019 line for telehealth because there just wasn't a lot of utilization, where there's an enormous jump in utilization in 2020. But even though there was a huge increase in the utilization of telehealth, we still lost almost 7 million mental health services for kids. And I think that that's especially concerning because we know anecdotally and based on preliminary evidence that there is a growing mental health crisis due to the pandemic. So we're sort of losing services at the same time that the need for services is increasing. And I think that is especially concerning. And then you're seeing here some of that state variation, which is, once again, reiterating that message that service use is declining in nearly all states, but the rate of that decline really does vary. And then this slide is showing the services, mental health services delivered through telehealth, and that it spiked in April for many states, but in others it only increased slightly. So there is variation in terms of that spike, and it also does appear that service delivery via telehealth did start to level off or decline again in May, which makes sense because many places were reopening for in-person visits. Okay, so this slide is showing a map, and this is just showing a shot in time of the month of April, basically, so you can see that state variation because April is the month where we saw that really drastic increase in the use of telehealth. So we focus on April because that's just when the sharpest increase was, and we wanted to capture that state variation. So looking at this map, once again, you can see there was a major increase in the utilization of telehealth for any service, but there was a lot of variation across states in terms of who was delivering services via telehealth. And so to add context to this, this slide is showing that relationship for states over time. So as you can see, delivery of any services through telehealth to children increased across all states in April, but it started to decrease again in May. And like I said, that's likely because beneficiaries are returning to in-person visits, but it's still really interesting to see that time trend aspect of telehealth and how it relates to the similar decline in services in other areas. So these next few slides really focus on what is actually happening directly in terms of COVID-19. So in the beginning, we really focused on what are the services that are declining, what care are people forgoing, sort of what's happening as kind of a second-order effect. But it's also really useful to understand, you know, what is directly happening to kids and how do these things tie together. So from a testing standpoint, we have seen more than 250,000 Medicaid and CHIP beneficiaries under the age of 18 receive a test for COVID-19 in 2020. There is also substantial variation across states in terms of that testing for kids. But even with all of those tests, we have at this point only seen about 32,000 beneficiaries actually receive treatment. So tying back to that first number, you know, given that we're covering almost 40 million children, we've only seen about 32,000 receive treatment. So I think that that's very encouraging. Even if some of those other things we've covered are not as encouraging. And that translates to less than 0.1%. And this slide talks about inpatient stays. So what you can see here is at fewer than 1,000 of all of those nearly 40 million Medicaid and CHIP beneficiaries under age 19 have been hospitalized for COVID-19. You can see the variation there in terms of inpatient stays versus ICU stays and ICU stays with a ventilator use. I think this gets back to kind of reiterating that point that the preliminary results are encouraging for the outcomes for children directly due to COVID-19. And it is, in a lot of ways, we're very concerned about these secondary effects about the care that they might be missing. And then for these last two slides, I don't want to spend a bunch of time on them. It's more just to highlight that we put this state variation of kind of the fastest states and the slowest states for both IP claims and OT claims. So you can just go look at these and see there is substantial variation in terms of how quickly states submit. Please keep that in mind when you look at the results. We do expect the specific point estimates to change as we get more claims, but we really do think that this relationship will withstand the submission of new claims. So with that, I will conclude the presentation, and I look forward to all of your feedback and questions. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Kim. So at this point, we will take questions, and so we'll begin with the chat function. So those of you that would like to send your questions through the chat function, you may do that now, and then we will follow with questions through the phone. So if you can start sending your questions in, we will respond to those at this time.
Okay, and we have, I think, a couple of questions in the chat so far. So the first is, do we know what the enrollment rate was for the same time period that we're looking at here in 2019?
So we would have to, I could look that statistic up. It's not, I don't have it off the top of my head.
Okay. Okay. And then the second question is, did review of the TMSIS data compare the claims available in September 2020 for the March through May 2020 period with claims data available in September 2019 for the March through May 2019
okay.
claims period to try and account for the claims lag?
So I'm reading the question because I want to make sure that I follow. Exactly. Sorry. I want to make sure I answer the correct question. So what we did was for our claims lag data, we looked at 2018. So we looked at a prior year submission where we knew that we had the full universe of claims. And we basically said, okay, in this month in 2018, like for March, 4 months later, what percentage of claims for that claim type had a state submitted? So it is based on historical submissions because it's not possible for us to know what percentage of claims are submitted in real time since we don't have a sense for the full universe. So basically what we did was we looked at a prior year where we knew we had a full sense of the universe of the claims, and we ranked states based on that. It is 100% possible that that looks different this year, that states, there are changes in states that would make that look different. So that in the future, when we have more information, we could go back and update with that additional knowledge. In terms of comparing the results, we compared March, April, and May of 2020 to March, April, and May of 2019 to calculate those changes that we referenced in the slides.
Okay, and then we have another question. What have the impacts been to behavioral health providers who serve children in the loss of revenue due to the significant drop in services for children?
I think someone else would have to take that question. That is definitely outside my area of expertise.
Ashley, can you repeat the question, please?
Sure. What have the impacts been to behavioral health providers who serve children in the loss of revenue due to the significant drop in services for children?
So I'm not sure if Jen Bowden has joined us and she can speak to any of the provider relief fund support that is either generally available to behavioral health providers or specifically targeted to behavioral health providers.
Hi, Amory. Thanks. Hi, this is Jen Bowden. So dentists, as with other Medicaid and CHIP providers, are eligible are have been eligible for general distribution payments under the Provider Relief Fund, and we're eligible for up to 2% of annual revenues as a relief payment. You know, I think part of the question is about sort of more broadly about the impact, and I don't know that we necessarily through the Provider Relief Fund have data yet to be able to look specifically at the impact of COVID on dentists and lost revenues. So others may have additional information that they could share in that regard.
Okay.
We can take that back as well. Sorry, so go ahead.
No, that's okay. So there's one more question. How can states get state-specific data?
So I can tell you that based on all the feedback and questions that we've gotten from states, this definitely seems like something that states are very interested in and would be very useful to them. So this afternoon, I've already started brainstorming with the team what options we have, and we will discuss that internally at DSG and see what options we have for sharing state-specific results with states.
Okay, Ashley, I don't see any other questions in the queue. Do you?
There is a question that just came in. Is there data available for the declines in adult services as well?
Yes, so CMS is monitoring these things internally. So today we focused on our public release. We are monitoring a number of different factors that map to not only COVID-19 results, but key areas for the Medicaid and CHIP programs. So we are monitoring that. We're still working on developing results that we could share publicly, and as we have that information available, we will do our best to share it. But that is something that we are very concerned about and would like to discuss in the future.
Thank you. So I think now we're ready to open up the phone lines. Operator, can you give the instructions for that?
Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, if you have any questions at this time, you can simply press star 1 on your telephone keypad. And if your question has been answered and you would like to withdraw your registration, you can press the pound key. Please hold while we compile the Q&A roster at this time. Our first question comes from the line of Harvin Goyal.
Yes, thank you very kindly. I'm Medicaid Medical Director in Illinois, and I have two related questions. It appears from your very important data that the increase in telehealth services did not necessarily offset the decrease in preventive, mental health, and other services that you mentioned. Then the second takeaway, and I would like to ask if you have any cost analysis, it appears that the non-managed care states may have benefited from, at least financially, the money that they saved they can use for something else, maybe enhance these services going forward. And could you comment on the cost part of it and the managed care part of it, which is prepaid?
So I can say that your takeaway from the telehealth standpoint is absolutely correct. For the second part about cost and managed care, that was just beyond the scope of this analysis, so we have not had the chance to look at that in relation to these results yet.
Thank you.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, again, if you have any questions at this time, you can simply press star 1 on your telephone keypad. There are no further questions at this time on audio.
Thank you. So we certainly have time at the end of the agenda, but I will move on with the next topic. And as Amory indicated, I would like to provide an update on the COVID-19 public health emergency as it relates to some of the new public health emergencies that we've recently experienced. And as all of you are aware, we have experienced a couple new natural disasters within the last couple months. We have Hurricane Laura and then the wildfires in Oregon and California. And so a number of states are asking how this impacts the current COVID-19 waivers that they do have in place. The guidance that we're providing now is that states may continue to use their approved Medicaid Section 1135 waivers through the end of the COVID public health emergency, which is expiring October the 23rd. And that could change if the secretary determines there is a need for an extension. States may also request additional public health emergency flexibilities through new public health declarations. So if a state determines that there is a need for new flexibilities based on the new event, they can certainly do that. But we want to make sure that states and territories are cognizant of the public health emergency expiration dates, because there could be a gap if you are using flexibilities for the COVID-19 and then you have a new public health emergency. So just be aware of the expiration dates, and then so that you can make sure the needs of your beneficiaries and providers are taken care of. In addition to that, Medicare has also issued guidance so that the COVID-19 Medicare blanket waivers are available to the healthcare providers, and that does include Medicaid and CHIP, so that these are available through the duration of the COVID-19 public health emergency and for the state's new public health emergency. So that is very consistent with the guidance that Medicaid is providing. I also want to touch a bit on a few of the other flexibilities that states and territories have been using through COVID-19 so you understand the interrelationship with the new flexibilities and the new public health emergencies. So with the 1915C HCBS waivers, a state may also continue to utilize the flexibilities approved through their Appendix K amendments under the COVID-19 public health emergency. But we do recommend that states do assess whether it would need additional flexibilities based on the new public health emergency. And once the state determines if a need does exist, then they can submit additional Appendix K amendments under the new public health emergency. And that does include services authorized under Section 1115 demonstrations. So just as a reminder, as you know, the 1135 flexibilities do expire once the public health emergency expires. But under the Appendix K, that is a bit different. It's not tied to the end of the public health emergency. So please refer to the date of the most current approval letter that you have for the Appendix K, because those can be approved up to 1 year after the effective date of the public health emergency, unless the state specifies that they want an earlier ending date. And as far as the Medicare disaster relief spas, many of you have requested flexibilities through this, and states may also continue to use these approved spa flexibilities through the end of the COVID-19 public health emergency. And if the state does identify that new needs exist with the new public health emergency, then they must also submit existing state plan page, preprint pages to make those further changes. So it's pretty consistent that you can continue to use the flexibilities in place. And then as you see that new flexibilities are needed based on the new public health emergencies, then those would need to be requested. Many of you have asked about the 1115 demonstrations, and as you're aware, those are considered on a case-by-case basis, so that we would just ask that you contact CMS, specifically your project officer for the 1115 demonstrations, and they can explore what potential flexibilities could be accomplished through the demonstrations. And as we have been working with states through the COVID-19 and the new flexibilities, we are continuing to monitor to see what activities are occurring with the hurricanes. As you know, we're currently in the hurricane season, and also other types of natural disasters could occur. So we are keeping a close eye on those. And once we anticipate new public health emergencies could be declared, we are working very closely with the states and territories to identify possible new flexibilities that they may need. So we're always available to provide any kind of technical assistance that you may need. So you know to contact your state lead. You can also contact Courtney Miller. She's our group director for MCOG, or you could contact me. So we are available to continue any kind of conversations or any questions that you may have. And we just, you know, welcome any kind of discussions that you'd like to have on this. So that really concludes my points that I wanted to make about the new public health emergencies as they relate to COVID-19. So we would like now to open up the phone lines to see what general questions you may have on the presentations you heard today or any other questions you may have. So I'll ask the operator to open up the phone lines at this point.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, again, if you have any questions at this time, you can simply press star 1 on your telephone keypad. Our first question comes from a line of Henry Lippman.
Good afternoon, and thank you for the presentation and the opportunity to ask questions this afternoon. I was wondering if you could give us any update on the clearance status of the toolkit for at the end of the public health emergency with respect to redeterminations and the like that states need to make.
Anne-Marie, should I turn that to you?
Oh.
Go ahead. Or Jessica.
Go ahead, Jessica. Hi, Jessica. Sure. And I know that we have indicated this a couple of times on a few calls, but wanted to just note that we are aware that states are thinking about plans for redeterminations and other actions that they'll need to take at the end of the public health emergency. We are still in the process of pulling together guidance for states that is forthcoming to provide a little bit more direction on sort of actions that states will need to take after the end of the public health emergency to catch up on redeterminations and sort of the timing of that work. We know that a number of states are already thinking about the work that they need to do, and if you have specific questions, may not be able to answer all of them at the moment, but helpful for you to share those with us as we think through the guidance that we will be providing in short order.
Thank you. Just one other question, if I could, and it's related to CMS policy with respect to, and I know this has been under consideration, it still may be, so with respect to CARES Act funds and how that relates to uncompensated care, if there's any update in that space.
Jan, can I ask you to take that one?
I think that would be for FMG.
Okay. Rory or Jeremy?
Henry, I think we'll need to get back to you.
Sure. I understand. Thank you.
Bye.
Appreciate it. Have a good day.
Okay, we have our next question. Please go ahead and state your name at this time.
Hi, this is Stephen Costantino from the state of Delaware. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. I just really appreciate the presentation, and it kind of feeds into an Appendix K issue and retention payments. Has there been any consideration of going beyond the 3 30-day periods that you can implement retention payments, especially, you know, given even the presentation today of the, you know, kind of underutilization of many services and trying to keep our networks fiscally viable? And I was just wondering if there's any consideration of that. Thank you very much.
Ralph?
Sure. I can tell you that the 3 30-day episodes was a very significant policy that was generated through CMS. The goal, as you've already stated, was to keep the infrastructure of the long-term services and supports in the community intact, but it was also believed and felt that during that time frame, the providers should be able to work out a way to ensure that services were again delivered to the individual, that meaning that either the services are delivered remotely or the services are the provider pool is expanded to include, for instance, family members, or that there are rate adjustments to allow for the provider pool to render services in a manner as they open their day programs that allow for more spacing of clients and therefore more spacing out of the service delivery system. But there is a balance here with regard to fiscal integrity. It is not Medicaid's normal process to pay for services not to be rendered. And then there is the other push of individuals needing services and needing contact with others during this extremely significant time frame. And I think that that's the other issue here, is that families and individuals cannot be left without for long durations of time. Now, the interpretation of the retainer payments allowing for it to be provided only during billable days allows the stretching of that 30 consecutive days, for instance, for rehabilitation programs that are rendered 5 days a week, to 6 weeks for one 30-day episode. So there was some significant latitude there, but an expectation that the provider, that our providers who are extremely talented and innovative would be able to find a way to render the service to the individual during this pandemic as retainer payments faded.
Yeah, and I don't disagree with anything you're saying. I just think that maybe the timing of the rebound has been delayed significantly. So I appreciate the balance issue. And I was just wondering if there was any more considerations
We completely understand that concern. The other thing I will tell you is that for another PHE, which is what started this conversation, there may be a need for retainer payments for that PHE specifically, for that disaster, and CMS would certainly discuss have a discussion there with the state regarding use.
Thank you very much.
To address that issue.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Okay.
Okay. We have our next question. Please go ahead and state your name at this time. Your line is open. Go ahead and state your name and ask your question.
Hi, my name is Molly Slavnik, from Maine, and my question is whether we know anything else about when there might be an announcement in relation to possibly extending the PHE beyond October 22nd.
Hi, this is Jackie, and we haven't been told as of yet. We normally don't hear until it's actually very close to the expiration date. So the expiration date is October the 23rd, so we may not hear anything until possibly a week before. So it usually, from this past experience, it usually comes around the time, that time it would expire. But we haven't heard anything on any updates yet at this point. But we'll keep everyone posted.
Okay, thank you.
All right, there are no more questions on audio.
Thank you. I do see a couple in the chat box. Ashley, did you want to cover those?
Sure. So the first question is on today's data presentation. Is the CDC VFC data available to match with the Medicaid claims data on vaccines?
So that is not currently available in our environment.
Him.
And then the other question is, are there any discussions happening around if the year expiration on an Appendix K is up, but there is still a public health emergency?
That's an issue that's in front of CMS now. We're aware that the PHE has gone much longer than expected, and that originally the Appendix K, which allowed for up to a year, provided some relief for providers who and states who thought the PHE would close earlier. As that time frame is extended, we continue to look at the options to ensure that the states continue to receive support. I don't have a definitive answer now. I can tell you that, yes, we are discussing ways to ensure that states are not without support during this time frame if it extends beyond a year.
Okay. And I think that's all for questions in the chat right now.
Thank you, Ashley. Are there any other questions on the phone?
Again, we don't have any questions on the phone line.
Okay. All right, then. So I think we could probably wrap up a little early today then. But first of all, I'd like to thank Kim very much for her excellent presentation. And we will send out invitations and topics for our future calls, so those are forthcoming. If you do have questions in the meantime, please reach out to your state leads, and we'll be happy to assist you. So we appreciate everyone joining us today and hope everyone has a great afternoon. Thank you.
That does conclude the conference call for today. We thank you for your participation and ask that you please disconnect your line.